Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. As Dr. Soldat was mentioning, in some respects, when I agreed to give this presentation, at some point down the line, I thought this is almost like some sort of graduate student class of representing other scientists' data and seeing how accurately you're able to pull it off. So with that, we'll begin. When I started thinking about this topic, I mean, the most obvious thing that came to mind for me was why this is important is really related to surface water quality. And whether you're looking at a small contained pond or lake in an urban or suburban setting, or you're looking at the upper straits of Mackinac connecting Lake Huron and Lake Michigan, certainly where we're positioned in the country, surface water quality is on everyone's mind, not only from an aspect of possibly human consumption and how we use water, but also for recreation and other purposes. And of course, this summer, this issue became very pertinent for Lake Erie. And for those of you that aren't familiar with this issue, it was right around, I believe, Labor Day weekend, where there was a fairly significant cyanobacterial algae bloom in Lake Erie. And this is one of the satellite images that I was able to find reflecting this. Now, if you're not really familiar with the geography in this area, so up in this area would be Detroit, Michigan, and then, of course, right down in this neck of the lake is where Toledo resides. And Toledo became an area where their water intake out in Lake Erie was essentially within this zone of bacterial bloom, and it resulted in the Toledo Water District essentially telling people for a 2 to 3 day period, you can't drink the water. And of course, this becomes a rather significant issue, obviously, when all of a sudden your water is turned off and they tell you go buy bottled water, or they're starting to ship it in from other locations because all of it in the Toledo area is gone. It affected roughly 500,000 people between Toledo and southeast Michigan. And I was very interested in this when this first occurred, just from an aspect of media coverage and what was going to be talked about and what was going to be given for the cause and or blame of this issue. And this was just one of them that I found online from the Huffington Post, where this author had said that one of the main factors in the Lake Erie algae blooms is thought to be increased phosphorus present in fertilizers, both commercial and manure, for agriculture and lawn maintenance, enters the waterway through runoff where algae feeds on it. However, I have to tell you, I was somewhat surprised when this issue first popped up, because when I was starting to see all of the articles in our local newspapers, since it was affecting portions of Michigan, quite a few of them did not even mention lawns as a potential contributor, which was kind of completely contrary to what we typically see when there's been any sort of water quality issue. And of course, if you look at the nature of the phosphorus restrictions that have occurred, in states, starting with the state of Minnesota, which restricted phosphorus use in the early 2000s, and it kind of cascaded, obviously, especially through the upper Midwest and the Great Lakes states. And, of course, you can see my state of Michigan there being represented. We did this two, three years ago now. But when this first happened, of course, with the problem in Toledo, people started asking, well, what is turf contributing? What type of risk is there? And, of course, we kind of looked at it and said, well, we restricted a couple of years ago. However, you notice at least one of the other states that borders Lake Erie here, let me get my cursor to come up, the state of Ohio, our neighbors to the south, do not have restrictions in place yet. And I've kind of been following this in the press clippings, and I haven't seen too much discussion yet, at least openly, as far as are they going to move to that point? Do they feel they need to, or are they looking at more agricultural issues? Now, if you look at these states that have had the phosphorus restrictions put in place, and primarily, at least from my experience, they're always really targeting homeowners and what the homeowners were applying, how they were applying it, maybe how much they were applying, whether they were real or kind of guess at numbers. And at least 2 years, I think it was 2 to 3 years ago now, I think one of the most significant things that happened was the Scotts Company took phosphorus out of their turf builder line. So all of a sudden, you know, from a homeowner perspective, some of these choices of being able to go into whatever your favorite retail outlet or garden center is and grab a bag of fertilizer for your lawn, does it have phosphorus in it? The number one supplier of these products, the Scotts Company, there's no phosphorus left in it. So that might have had as big an impact maybe on application practices and phosphorus going into the landscape as any of these restrictions that we've seen put in place. So if you look at you know, how we define urban grasslands, and I kind of include every turf use you can think of here, lawns, golf courses, athletic fields, commercial properties, schools, you know, everything that could be a turf surface in the urban or suburban environment. Of course, this was the map that Dr. Soldat had in his previous presentation looking at fractional turf grass area. And when you look at the origination of this map, this started with essentially a look at if there is this much impervious surface in an area, then we're going to make a conclusion that there's this much turf grass. So, you know, whether it's completely accurate, it certainly reflects the suburban areas throughout the United States. And their estimates were that there are 3 times more acres of lawns in the U.S. than irrigated corn, and that lawns were the single largest irrigated crop in terms of surface area. Now, I think some of us, depending on the region we live in, would possibly dispute that all these lawns are certainly irrigated. Certainly, if you look at desert environments versus where we are in the Great Lakes states, I'm not even sure half of our lawns are irrigated, or as I would refer to it sometimes when I'm discussing with homeowners, it oftentimes becomes recreational irrigation when they're out there lighting up the barbecue to make some hamburgers at night. Now, managed turf on golf courses from the GCSAA survey, they're adding another roughly 6,000 square kilometers. So when you look at, you know, the landscapes we're managing and trying to answer this question of urban grasslands, are they a phosphorus source or sink to the watersheds that they're integrated with? You know, we've all seen this before, the general representation of a phosphorus cycle. And when we've been talking about phosphorus and its risk to any of our waterways, we're primarily looking at this area up here. We're looking at runoff issues, whether it's erosion of soil particles, whether it's soluble phosphorus that might be related to a recent fertilizer application, or in the case of, I think, many of our homeowner practices, we always talk to them about, you know, the simple things. Don't apply to impervious surfaces where you have granules left on the surface that then obviously can wash down the gutter and make their way directly to the waterway. So the areas I'd like to cover to try to answer this question are, first of all, looking at the effect of soil phosphorus level on the impact of what is going into the waterways. Secondly, looking at some studies that look at the effect of landscape, site runoff risk, and management practices on that landscape. Third, the effect of fertilizer program. And then finally, to finish up, the effect of buffer strips. So this figure, I think you'll commonly find possibly in some soil texts, where it looks at, on the x-axis here, the soil test phosphorus concentration, and then on the y-axis, the dissolved phosphorus concentration in runoff. And showing essentially a one-to-one relationship there, as you increase soil test phosphorus level, you're going to increase the amount of dissolved phosphorus concentration in the runoff. Now, Dr. Soldat, in his PhD work at Cornell University, looked at this effect, but he looked at it and said, okay, I want to start with, what is that effect on soil test phosphorus level when you don't have turf cover and then when you add turf cover? So essentially that bare soil scenario we saw in the previous slide, and then what happens if you add turf? And if you look at this figure, it's very similar to the previous slide, that you have almost that direct linear increase in soil test phosphorus level on the y-axis. The phosphorus in the runoff increases rather dramatically on the y-axis. And notice the R-square there in that figure is 0.68. So it's a fairly good fit for this data. So this is without turf. You add turf. What happens to the relationship? And the relationship essentially starts to break down. Now you notice you have an R square value of 0.035, which in most cases we would say, well, it's good luck trying to fit a line to that data. So in this case, you have higher soil test phosphorus levels, but what's coming off when there is the turf grass added to it doesn't reflect those values. And I think that's an important point, especially in many of these states where we have the phosphorus restrictions in place now. Many of them have high soil phosphorus levels. And that, in fact, has become one of the caveats, I think, on a lot of those pieces of legislation is soil tests to indicate need before you would even consider applying. Now, some different work that's looking at watersheds, and this is from Easton and Petrovic. This was done at Cornell University studying a watershed in Ithaca, New York. 332-hectare watershed, 40% of it was developed when they did this research, and they collected runoff from various points in this watershed. And this one was a little complicated to kind of sort through, but basically they looked at three different landscape types. They classified these as low maintenance, which was unfertilized turf, and when they described this in the article, they were talking about, you know, it might have been a utility right-of-way, it might have been school ground that wasn't fertilized. And certainly in many of these areas, when you think about low maintenance turf, it doesn't end up just being 100% turf. It's often the mix with whether it's clover, plantain, dandelion, whatever is mixed in there to fill in the ground cover where the turf might have a void. The second landscape type was high maintenance. And this was a generalization as good as they could find of approximately 150 kilograms of N per hectare per year and 28 kilograms of phosphorus per hectare per year being applied to what we'd consider typical home lawns, but maybe on the, I guess we would say, the upper scale of management for home lawns. And then the third landscape they looked at was wooded areas, which of course would just be unmanaged native woodlots or forested areas. So this first table looks at the influence of landscape type and site runoff risk on the average volume of suburban runoff over a two-year period. So they have the three landscapes, the high maintenance, or HM, they're indicating the fertilized lawn, low maintenance, unfertilized, and then the FR for the forested. And then you can see on this area of the table over here where they talk about site runoff risk being low, medium, and high. And how they classified that was based on somewhat relation to where that landform sat in the watershed. So if it was considered a high site risk, that was sitting closer to where any runoff exiting that would be going directly into the water body. If it was low risk, it was further upstream, so to speak. And it also had some soil differences that they were able to characterize, where that high risk area tended to be a shallower soil, so not as much chance probably for infiltration of that precipitation before you'd get a runoff event. Now, if you look just at, for example, not trying to look at every portion of this data, but just the averages between the high maintenance, the low maintenance, and the forested, and you can see just in terms of runoff volume that actually the fertilized turf, which probably resulted in better plant density than either of the unmanaged or just the native forest, actually had lower runoff volume. But to look at the effect of phosphorus look at the effect of the phosphorus and the runoff from these landscapes types, you can look at this table, and this is rather complicated. On the top here, this portion of the table or figure is looking at dissolved phosphorus load. In the middle were particulate phosphorus, and then total phosphorus at the bottom. And then we have the three landscape types, with the black bar being the high maintenance lawn, the clear bar or the clear white bar being the low maintenance, and then the forested being the hatched here. And then on top of this, if you can keep to following this, we have block one being the high risk, block two being the medium risk, and block three being the lowest risk. So if you look at, just focus on kind of this left side of the figure, the high risk situation. If you look at where the phosphorus is coming from in the runoff events in this case, for both the low maintenance and the forested, you can see that actually the majority of the phosphorus that's coming off that site is from this middle figure here. It is the particulate phosphorus, which would be consistent with what you would think of a low-density vegetated landscape. When you look at the high-maintenance lawn, you can see the majority of the phosphorus that's coming off that high-maintenance fertilized turf is dissolved phosphorus, which you would probably point to that being consistent with, in this case, they were having phosphorus applications as part of their fertilizer program. And to kind of reinforce that point, when you look at a different aspect of this with plant density, runoff, and infiltration rate, you can see from this figure that as you would increase shoot density of the turf grass from the left to the right, you decrease runoff. And, of course, you have an associated increase, as my cursor went everywhere there, of infiltration. And this is something that I think as those of us that deal with making turf grass recommendations, talking to the general public in many cases, I think we often preach this, that density of turf grass is really the key to managing it, not only from the purposes of what we're talking about today of trying to reduce any soil erosion losses that might be contributing phosphorus in the watershed, but also if like you're on this picture here and you have all these gaps in the turf, it's probably not too long before they fill in with other pests that some people will certainly find objectionable and then will want to apply herbicides to get rid of. So turf density is definitely critical for this issue. Next research I'd like to just cover would be work from Dr. Brian Horgan at the University of Minnesota. And part of their research really focused on the effect of fertilizer programs on phosphorus runoff from home lawns. And as you can see in the picture here, this is a relatively small research plot runoff work. They looked at, they sodded this area with Kentucky bluegrass. The fertilizer sources for the nitrogen and potassium were 24-011 fertilizer. Then they had a triple superphosphate when they were applying phosphorus to the site. Basic practice is essentially to keep the turf grass alive from if they did have a dry period, but nothing extraordinary. Now, for the fertilizer treatments in 2005, this was the establishment year of this research, and then in 2006 through 9, this would be considered post-establishment, obviously. So the first year, the treatments that remain common between the two, whether establishment year or across post-establishment year, is number one, no fertilizer, so nothing applied. Second would be no phosphorus applied. So there was still nitrogen and potassium going down, nitrogen going down at approximately, I'll revert to my extension specialist ways here so I don't lose my track, 3 pounds of N. And the third treatment would be the complete fertilizer going down at a pound of phosphate along with 3 pounds of N for the season. And then the fourth treatment is, essentially I would look at this treatment as if the consumer was going to go out there and buy the triple products, the 12-12-12s, the 10-10-10 analysis of the world, apply that 3 times a year, they'd get 3 pounds of N, 3 pounds of phosphate. The treatments changed for the number 3 and 4 in the next 3-year cycle, where that was reduced to 0.3 pounds of phosphate on an annual basis and a pound for treatment 4. And when you start looking at some of the data they were able to collect, it's very interesting from the aspect of when you look at these figures, what time of year we're talking about. So in this case, this is data from the establishment year, soluble phosphorus runoff from frozen soil. So during the winter time through possibly even early spring. And you see these peaks here when you look at, so this would be the 3 pound of phosphate treatment, the 1 pound, no phosphorus, and then this bar here is the unfertilized control. Okay, so unfertilized control, but then this was receiving nitrogen and K, but no phosphorus. You can see, at least during the establishment year, when you looked at these runoff events, primarily what you were seeing is you put down a lot of phosphorus, you were getting a lot that was potentially running off from the site compared to the other fertilizer treatments. So this is frozen soil. When you look at unfrozen soil, and one thing I should point out, let me go back just quickly, on the y-axis here, look at the scale here, 0 to 700. So this was in soluble phosphorus in milligrams, 0 to 700 during frozen conditions. Unfrozen, you notice our scale has changed from 0 to 250, and for most of these events, it looks very minor, with the exception of one over here, runoff event 16, which was associated with a week-long precipitation event that dumped almost 9 inches of rainfall in a period of time. So kind of comparing just during that establishment year, if you put both those together, you'd say, well, the runoff risk is greatest during the dormant period when the turf is not actively growing. And we'll come back to that. When you look at 2006, which is comparing both frozen and unfrozen on the same slide, you see the magnitude of the differences there. For most events, where it was becoming significant was in the frozen conditions or high rainfall events that were causing or forcing runoff in the unfrozen conditions. One other thing to note with this, though, is look at that this control plot, which, keep in mind, the control in this case, the unfertilized, so no nitrogen, no phosphorus, no potassium, but then look at if we fertilize but we don't apply phosphorus. So there was much less coming off. So this really got to the point of looking at, you know, don't demonize fertilizer applications completely. Take phosphorus out of the equation, especially if you're on high soil or high phosphorus soils. But to take fertilizer out completely, you lose density and then you're increasing runoff events. And for those that maybe aren't as familiar with what turf potentially looks like either during winter or just coming out of winter, this was a snapshot from my back lawn. I think this was actually maybe early May this last year. And you can see, I mean, it kind of makes sense of why you have runoff events during this time of year. Not only following the snowmelt, there's no resistance there. I mean, this is basically flat, mat turf. There's nothing to slow it down, anything that's coming off, and you can see it's just barely starting to grow. So one other slide here to look at and just focus on kind of the highlighted portion here of the soluble phosphorus total column for the treatments that they had conducted here at Minnesota. And you can kind of see the range there of 0.04 up to 0.16 for what was coming off the non-fertilized control plot. And when you compare that to some of the numbers you've seen in agriculture, whether it's fallow, conventional corn, no-till corn, or a hay system, you can kind of see if you compare those, you say, well, there's certainly differences in these systems, but if you look at the ranges, turf grass in this case, I think, falls within these ranges, if not lower in some cases. And that would be the same of probably all but essentially the native forest, which had a very low amount coming off. But native prairie would be on the kind of the same order as you would see with the turf grass. So summarizing the Minnesota work, basically I think you saw that 86% of phosphorus runoff was when the soil was frozen, 78% of that runoff depth when the soil was frozen, and really properly fertilized turf can potentially reduce phosphorus runoff. Now the final thing to just talk about quickly is buffer strips. And this was some work from Steinke and Steyer at the University of Wisconsin where they're evaluating the effect of prairie and turf buffer strips on runoff from concrete slopes. So in this picture, you can kind of see they're looking at different ratios between, essentially, if you looked at a parking lot and said, what would we want to try to clean that water with before it would get into the drains? They'd say, well, if we put a native prairie planting versus a turf grass, how would that affect what comes off those sites? And once again, in this northern climate, they found 80% of the runoff of nutrients came in the winter. There was really no effect of vegetation or buffer size as far as that ratio. And their conclusion, frozen ground, I like this, trumps vegetative buffer strips for controlling urban runoff. So I think certainly to try to answer the question I posed at the beginning, are urban grasslands phosphorus source or sink for watersheds? I think certainly you'd have to say that like any landscape type that's out there, there is some contribution. Do we think if they're properly managed, it is a large contribution, probably not related to some others. And I think this is where we get to a lot of our recommendations. Reduce runoff volume with management practices, advocate for turf grass density, soil test for phosphorus, and apply it when there is a need. And just to conclude, thanks to Dr. Horgan, Dr. Soldat, and Dr. Steinke who will help me by contributing some slides to this presentation. And since you're standing there, I'm guessing I'm done. Thank you. Questions, please?
Yeah,